I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, David Remnick talks with Gary Johnson, the Libertarian Party's candidate for president. Johnson discusses his platform and his feelings about Trump and Clinton.
One of the many incredible things about this presidential election, and none of us can count them at this point, is that Gary Johnson, a two-term governor of New Mexico and a former CEO of a company that sells marijuana products, is currently polling at around 8% in matchups against Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. In order to make it onto the presidential debate stage, he'll need to poll at 15%, but even if that doesn't happen, he's still on track to capture the largest share of the third-party vote for president since Ross Perot in the 1990s. On cultural issues, the Libertarians are often to the left of many Democrats, and on fiscal issues, they're often to the right of most mainstream Republicans. So they have enemies on all sides, and they make for some pretty strange alliances. But with the Republican Party now so fractured and chaotic, thanks to Donald Trump, this could be the year that a party of the sidelines moves closer to the center of American politics. Governor, I have to begin in the following way. There's just no way around it. Your former party, the Republican Party, seems to be in a state of chaos and even crack up. And you yourself have recently denounced Donald Trump, at least obliquely, as an authoritarian. When you were asked about it, you said, if it walks like a duck, et cetera, et cetera. As somebody who was a two-time governor and a loyal Republican, although now running as a libertarian, give me your analysis of the Republican Party. Where is it now?
Well, I think it's I think this is the demise of the Republican Party. I think that Donald Trump alienates more than half of Republicans, and you know, I've said this for a while now that I think most Republicans are about small government, and really that's just been co-opted. The deportation of 11 million undocumented workers, that's just founded in misinformation. They're not taking jobs that U.S. citizens want. Building a wall across the border, that's crazy. Killing the families of Muslim terrorists, that's crazy. He's all for free trade, but, you know, he's going to impose a tariff on imported goods. Who's going to pay for that? And you're going to force Apple to make their iPads and their iPhones in the United States? It just goes on and on and on.
But you're happy with him about guns.
Happy with him about guns? By happy, I support the Second Amendment. I don't know where he's at on any of these issues.
And yet you've had nice things to say about Hillary Clinton, notably on CNN. You talked about her as a competent and serious public servant.
Well, you know, I'd change that. I think, you know, sometimes you misspeak a little bit. I really do think that this whole Clinton Foundation is pay to play, and I've wondered a long time about these speaking fees that Bill Clinton has gotten, and just of late, for me personally, I've been able to connect the dots, and really, it's not a good thing.
Do you worry that there's any scenario in which a third party candidate could have a historic negative in many people's minds? Scenario as with Ralph Nader affecting things in a way that led to something that you came to hate, like the Iraq War?
Well, I think a wasted vote is voting for somebody that you don't believe in. And given the fact that these are the two most polarizing figures of all time and space that have ever run from the two major parties in the same race, I don't lose any sleep over that one.
Governor, since the path to winning is hugely dependent on getting to the debates and then performing in the debates. When you imagine yourself as a third party on a stage with Donald Trump, the Republican, and Hillary Clinton as the Democrat, how do you imagine that debate going, and how in your mind, and how it goes well for you? Why would you?
I hope I don't intimidate the two of them too much. you know, having been governor of New Mexico for two terms, having more executive experience than the two of them, I just, you know, not to fear. I'm not going to throw rocks. I'll leave that for others. But I would really like to talk about policy.
And where would the avenues of attack or avenues of explanation be? What I'm having a difficult time, Governor, is latching on to the one or two big themes in your campaign in terms of policy? And I'd like to tease that out.
Well, smaller government, that we would be proposing a balanced budget. To propose a balanced budget, you have to reform the entitlements. You can't do that without reforming the entitlements, Medicaid and Medicare. Social Security is headed for a fiscal cliff, so there's reform to Social Security, not cutting it, but reform so that it is around in the future. And then you can't balance the federal budget unless you're going to actually cut the military.
So tell me how to reform Medicare and Medicaid. People tend to like the benefits that they do have once they become part of the culture. What are the specifics on how you would lower costs on Medicare and Medicaid? Would you change the ages? I mean, how would you deal with Social Security to stabilize it?
Well, you are talking about regarding Social Security. I do believe that the retirement age needs to get raised.
To what?
Look, I'm not getting elected king or dictator here. I'm looking to get elected president of the United States. That has constitutional limits, so I either get to support or not support what comes out of Congress. I would recommend raising the retirement age. 72 seems like a good starting point. Mm-hmm. With regard to Medicaid and Medicare, I believe that Medicaid has to devolve to the states.
Would you roll back Obamacare, as some people on the Republican side of the aisle have urged?
Well, I think the cat is out of the box, but when it comes to reforming our healthcare system, I think what is needed is a free market approach to healthcare. And I'll just add that healthcare is as far removed from free market as it possibly can be.
Is there a free market medical system somewhere in the world that you admire?
I can't think of a single one.
You've been honest about and funny about, in both the New Yorker piece about you by Ryan Liz and many other venues, about smoking marijuana and having eating edibles. The last time you got high was with a Chiba Chew, Ryan. Lizard reports, a Colorado brand that High Times once called America's favorite edible. And yet you've sworn off now. And I wonder why. You know, Barack Obama certainly ends a working day very often with a martini or two. Why do you feel duty bound to do that?
Well, the whole notion of inbound missiles, you got 12 minutes to deal with that. I have never advocated being on the job impaired. And running for president is a 24/7 job, and being president is a 24/7 job. You know, I haven't had a drink of alcohol in 29 years. That had to do with being the best that I could be. My whole life is about health and wellness and fitness, and I take great pride in it. So I hope when it comes to my admission that the last time I consumed marijuana was 3 months ago, I hope more than anything that people would just recognize that here's a guy who tells the truth. And if you tell the truth, you know, it's really hard to do harm to somebody who's telling the truth regardless of the consequences.
You've been very bold and direct about declaring the war on drugs in general a gigantic failure. What policy direction would you take as president regarding drugs beyond marijuana?
Well, I have never advocated anything but the legalization of marijuana. I think when we legalize marijuana, when the whole country comes to have that pass, I think we're going to take a giant leap as a nation and understand first and foremost that drugs are a health issue rather than a criminal justice issue. And if we start looking at harm reduction strategies, and by that, reducing death, disease, crime, corruption, the things that we genuinely care about, that we will actually accomplish that.
What's the path to accomplishing that? I think many people have said what you've said, but when it comes to a full medicalization and legalization path, as we've seen in some countries, it's a very, very rocky road.
Well, just take an example of, and here I'm sitting in Burlington, but if Burlington wanted to deal with a heroin overdose epidemic, and I don't know what the heroin situation here is in Burlington.
It's horrendous in Vermont.
Well, okay, so how do you
do it? In New England generally, it's been terrible.
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, that's a situation everywhere. Well, if communities really genuinely cared about that, and look, this is not a federal government issue, but if communities really cared about it, they'd set up a clinic for testing of heroin. Bring your heroin in. You're not going to get arrested. Bring your heroin in, and we'll test it to tell you whether or not it's going to kill you or not. And that would be a harm reduction strategy.
Governor, I'm a little confused on your anti-gun control views. In the wake of the mass shooting in Orlando, where 49 people were killed, you had said that Americans would be safer if guns were more readily available, not more restricted. Now, I'm a little unclear why you think this is the case. I understand your support of the Second Amendment and your interpretation of it, but we should even be selling guns to people who are on terrorist watch lists? I mean, where does, can so, regulation so, play a role here?
So, David, I'm not sure where you got this, people should have more guns. I have
USA Today.
Pardon me?
Well, USA Today.
No. I have no doubt that you're quoting something, but I don't think I've ever advocated, look, everybody should have more guns. A situation like Orlando, I hope everybody paid attention to what happened in Orlando. I hope all the nightclub owners in the country were paying attention to the fact that all the doors were padlocked.
Okay, but I don't think you're arguing that egress in and out of the nightclub was the question. We're talking about the ready availability of weapons that one would think are should be limited, I would think, and maybe we obviously disagree,
field of war. Limited, let's talk for a second about semi-automatic rifles. That's a category of rifle that there are over 30 million of them in this country. And if you're going to make those criminal, I think you're going to have a whole new criminal class of people that aren't going to turn in those weapons.
Do you think it's a good thing that those guns are available?
Well, they are available. It's semi-automatic rifle. There are no—
Okay, but you're running for president. What's your position on whether they should be or not? This is a hot debate in American
should
political life.
Should be or not, we should be allowed to exercise our Second Amendment rights, David, which would be the ability to own a semi-automatic rifle.
So it's okay. So that's your position.
And yes.
Should teachers, for example, is it a good idea for
teachers? I'm not going to tell teachers whether or not they should have a gun or not. Come on, man.
No, it's not come on, man. It's a question
of
is it a good idea for a teacher to have it in classrooms, as has been suggested
if a teacher would deem that to avail the classroom of potentially being secure, or if the teacher were to deem that something that within their own purview they might prevent an atrocity if it were to occur, I would support the teacher in wanting to be able to do that.
Okay. There's one form of government that I'm not sure of your attitude toward. You are a committed environmentalist, as I understand it, and you also support the EPA. The Environmental Protection Agency, so far as I understand it. Isn't that another form of big government? It certainly is to some on the right.
Well, government is, if anyone believes that there isn't a 20% largesse in government, we're not on the same page. That said, I do think that the EPA comes under the fundamental heading of protecting us, and that government exists to protect us against individuals, groups, corporations, foreign governments that would do us harm. And I put pollution in the category of harm, and having been governor of New Mexico, but for the federal EPA, there would still be a major polluter existing in northern New Mexico that, because they refused to clean up, as governor, I was able to designate them as a Superfund site, which was about the heaviest anvil that I had to had in my bag.
Governor, politics apart, what would you say is the most formative experience in your life that helped shape who you are?
Well, I think it's a unique combination of being an entrepreneur and an athlete, and then my family. I mean, it's and that's no different than most people, but that has focused my life. I'm an optimistic character. I'm somebody who recognizes that failure is a part of everyday life, and it's ultimately how you deal with failure that determines success.
Did you have a failure that was formative to you?
Well, Well, growing my business from a one-person handyman, me, to 1,000 employees, I have to tell you that along the way, death was not worse than the life I was living, which was just keeping up with cash flow and growth and the failure and the, you know, it was not easy. It was not easy. It was incredibly hard work. And, you know, like so many, I survived and went on to what I'll call great success.
Governor, are there a few books that you could say that encapsulate your philosophy of either governing or of life itself?
You know, I Ayn Rand. I love The Fountainhead. I love Atlas Shrugged. I do read, but those are a couple of books that I think, from a philosophical standpoint, I think Fountainhead is my favorite book.
That was David Remnick talking to Gary Johnson.